Well, we appreciate those of you who braved the perils of one of our monsoons. You can never predict what we're going to have for weather in Kentucky. But good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation. This is our 10th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz. I'm the head of the Department of Library and Public Services. I coordinate this series with my colleague back there, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster taking pictures over here, Haiwan Wan, and our instruction coordinator in the red shirt, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Eric Fisher. Our speaker tonight is a native of Tucson, Arizona. His mother, Patricia Perry, from Chicago, had moved to the desert with her family since her mother suffered from heart problems. His father, William Tuller, from Teaneck, New York, contracted tuberculosis while flying blimps for the Navy and was rehabilitating at a veterans hospital in Tucson, where he met and married Patty in 1944. All four of their children were born in Arizona. His father's employment in the insurance industry took them to Hawaii for 3 years, where the kids learned to surf, and their mother added to her culinary skills, and then back to California, where their house was badly damaged in the earthquake of 1971. Our speaker left for college when he was 18 and in 1971 was commissioned as a naval ensign and was sent to Explosive Ordnance Disposal School in Maryland. He later graduated, entered graduate school in Los Angeles, and began studying for an MA in marriage and family counseling. Meanwhile, his parents and brother had moved to Germany for 3 years before returning stateside, bereft of funds. However, fate shined on the family, and while working for a mobile home factory in Florida, his father found employment with FEMA and in 1975 visited Grand Rivers, Kentucky. He fell in love with the place, acquired an old motel, and moved the family to Kentucky. In 1977, his mother Patty got the idea to open a hamburger and ice cream parlor in Grand Rivers. With the promise of half of this future business, they persuaded our speaker and his partner, Michael Grimes, to abandon life in the fast lanes of Los Angeles to move to the small, tiny hamlet of Grand Rivers, Kentucky. The rest, as they say, is history, and Patty's 1880 settlement restaurant has grown to become one of Kentucky's most famous and most visited culinary destinations. In 1996, Patty's was named as one of the top three small-town restaurants in the South. Chip is a past president of the Kentucky Restaurant Association and with his brother received the Kentucky Small Business Persons of the Year Award in 1994. And here to tell us how those two-inch thick pork chops, bread baked in flower pots, and that mile-high meringue pie got to be so famous is proprietor Chip Teller. Welcome, Chip.
Not used to getting out into the big city. And I don't talk in big groups, so it's a good thing this is a small one.
The picture is of my mother, Miss Patty, in 1975, and the building is where the restaurant is today. That's what it started out looking like. So I thought I'd pass it around so y'all could sort of see what the beginning looked like. And we have some pictures later. I'll show you what it is today.
Since we're beforehand and if we can sort of have a little bit of fun before I get introduced, I'm going to have a little question and answer period here. When you see a video, you'll see, I'm going to show it shortly, it's a story about my mother, and she was Miss Patty. And there's a teapot, very Art Nouveau teapot, sitting there next to me. And that's my mother. She's in the teapot. And so I was going to bring her and set her on the table and so she could be here. She lives in the house with me. And my father is in a plaster of Paris pig and that a lady friend of his made for her. And the pig has a pair of overalls. And he has hee-haw painted all over because my father walked around with a pig on the end of the leash with hee-haw overalls on. So I was going to bring the pig and the overalls and set Mom and Dad over here so they could be here at this gathering. But Michael Lee told me I couldn't bring the pig and this mom to the gathering. So just out of curiosity, if I had brought mother and dad, how many would have said it was okay? And how many would have, like, oh, raise an okay hand, too. Oh, see, I told you I could have brought him. When my mother passed away with Garrett's disease, she passed away at home. And she lived just a couple blocks from it was probably 150 feet from the restaurant. And when she died, she passed away in bed with her dear friends with her. And we set her up in her bed, at which she and I. She loved to write, so I had a little writing tray and our family flowers, a rose. So I put the bud vase there, and I put a fresh rose in it. And we put a ball cap on her head that said Patty's, and we took and told the kids at Patty's that Mom had passed away, and that if they wanted to talk to her, visit with her, this was the only time, so they could come over. So a lot of the employees, which I call kids at Patty's, because I'm a lot older than they are now, but some of them anyway, and they came over and talked to Mom and stuff. It was really pretty neat. And so my dad and my brothers and I went to the funeral parlor, and we ordered a box for Mom's ashes. She wanted to be cremated, to go in. And we came home and we told all the mother's ladies' friends that had gathered that we had picked out a box. And the lady said, oh, no, you can't put mother in just a box. Your mother in a box. You have to put her in something that was near and dear to her. Well, we had gone on a vacation to Mexico. My mother, at the end of her life, loved to travel. And her little bag was packed and ready to go at the front door anytime anybody would take her anywhere. The last trip I took her to was in Mexico, and because we grew up as children in Hawaii, and she loved the ocean. So we took her to Mexico, and when we were riding or walking around Mexico and stuff, and one of the things I found this teapot, and it's really colorful, and it just looked like my mom. So I bought it for her and handed it to her and said, this is for you, Mom. And she loved it. So I found the teapot, saw the teapot in her house, and so mother's in the teapot. Dad's in the plaster of Paris pig. So when you see it, you'll see who she's next to me. She's always with me whenever we go. She passed away about 14 years ago. Dad passed away 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago. They had been married 50 years when she passed away, 51 years. The restaurant, my mom and dad, I'll tell you a little bit about how our story started. My father grew up in the John Hancock Life Insurance Company and developed quite a name, and the company moved him to Hawaii from Los Angeles when I was about 5.5 years old. And we grew up there for the next 6 years, and it was a wonderful experience. We lived right on the ocean. We learned how to swim and fish and sail, and it was just a marvelous time. My father became more and more successful, and he was promoted to move to Los Angeles, and he was given the whole territory of Los Angeles and greater Los Angeles for the new John Hancock Company. He did very well. I grew up at that point in time as basically a Leave It to Beaver family. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. She raised four kids. She was always dressed up, always ready for my father to bring unexpected guests to the house for dinner. So she grew up as a host and hostess, and I grew up as the oldest son. My sister is 5 years older than I am, watching what Mom would do. I hung out with my mom a lot. One of my fun stories is back in those days, the ladies always wore stockings with the black line down the back. And she would always come to me and ask if the line was straight, and if it wasn't, I'd have to straighten the line out. And that was one of the fun stories. Anyway, she was a very good cook. She was a very good housewife, and she was a very good hostess. And one of the things that she taught me was the essence of how to take care of guests, how to be friendly with people. I grew up in a generation where you were taught respect. You know, you didn't lie, you didn't steal, and you didn't back talk to your mother and father. You called everybody Mr. or Mrs. that was older than you. You always answered the telephone at the house. Good afternoon, Teller residence, Chip speaking, may I help you? A lot of those things. We didn't have a TV till I was 11 and a half years old, and so we did a lot of outdoor activities, which was really fun. We moved to California, and I started school when I was in the eighth grade in California. My years in high school and junior high school were rather trying, to say the least. As you can take a look at me today, I don't like to really fit into any kind of box. I sort of like to be outside of the box. And I love Willie Nelson, so I got Willie Nelson hair. Also grew up in the era when San Francisco and the Haight-Ashbury hippies were going, and I always loved that, even though when I went away to college the first semester, my father, when I came home with hair that was a little bit beyond my ears, told me, you won't come home ever again looking like that. You must have your hair at the top of your ear. And we started a long discussion about that, and when I came home at Christmas time, I showed him a small ink drawing like this of Christ. And Christ said, if your parents have a problem with you having long hair, just tell them I said it was okay. Christ. My father was very impressed with my knowledge and my ability to debate and articulate my thoughts. And he told me, when Christ starts paying the bills in the house, then you can have long hair. Otherwise, no long hair. My life, the story is really difficult to separate where my life started and where my family started, but I'll give you just a little history with me. When I went off to college, my father had lost his job 2 years earlier. They'd lost their home. They'd lost everything they basically had. The aerospace industry had collapsed in California. In 1971, the big earthquake hit Granada Hills, California, and broke our house in half. And we didn't have earthquake insurance, and there wasn't anybody to sell the houses to, and so he lost the house. I went off to college just before they actually left the house, and I was driving up to Northern California in my old 10-year-old Ford station wagon that I had fixed up with, you know, curtains and shag carpeting and leather and diamond tuck interior and mag wheels in the front and slicks in the back, and you know, it's what hippies had. It's a great love mobile, you know. And was driving up to Bakersfield, and unfortunately my car's engine blew up. So I got out, and I had 10 paper bags with all my belongings in it, and I sat on the side of the Greyhound bus station, which in Bakersfield was merely just a wood bench. And the bus came by and picked me up and took me to Arcata, California. So I arrived in college with 10 paper bags. If you put it in the context of the day, you would probably really be laughed at. Well, trust me, in a small school of 3,500 people in a town of about 3,500 people, arriving with 10 paper bags was really quite humorous as well. But I decided for some strange reason that I wanted to be the president of the university, or other freshman class. So there had never been anybody elected out of a 50-mile radius of the college or university, and I was from 750 miles away. And all the things that I struggled with when I was in high school got left behind in Los Angeles, and I was a different individual. I was my own person, and I could create my own identity, which was really neat. So I walked around with a plywood board on me. It was had some straps on it, and it was bright yellow. And I wore it everywhere around the college, including classes, and it said, a vote for me is a vote for Chip, freshman class president, and I won. So it was really cool. That started my career. All of a sudden, I went from a nobody in school to a famous somebody in school, and had a lot of fun, did a lot of work. worked to, because my family didn't have the money to put me through college, I worked two jobs. I worked as a swimming instructor teaching kids how to swim, because in the state of California you had to know how to swim before you could graduate from college. And because I grew up in Hawaii learning how to swim like a fish, that was a natural thing. And I also grew up, went to work in the cafeteria with teachers' cafeteria, and I worked doing dishes. I put myself through the first 2 years of school, barely, a little help with my mom and dad. And then on my third year, I got accepted to go to the foreign exchange program and studied a year in Sweden. I picked Sweden because Sweden at the time was probably one of the most socially advanced cultures on the world, so I wanted to go and experience different attitudes about life. Happened to get there with the Vietnam War going full blast, so Americans were not very highly thought of. Remember, Sweden was neutral during the war, and they were really didn't think we should belong in Vietnam, and so it was interesting. The first night I went to a movie with a lovely young lady, we watched, what was the name of the movie? Easy Rider. And sitting in a movie theater in Sweden with Swedish people watching Dennis Hoffman get blown away in a motorcycle in the South was really troubling for me to try to explain, for them to try to understand. So I wrote a wonderful 4-page letter to President Nixon, and he wrote me a lovely 1-page form letter back saying that he was sorry the Vietnam War was what it was. And I thought, I didn't write about that. I wrote about what the country appears to be like to someone living outside of the country. Moral of the story, if you can get out of the country and visit other cultures, please do it while you're young, because you may not have time when you get old. I got graduated from University of California, Northridge. I had been offered a full graduate fellowship in behavioral psychology. I was lucky enough to have one of the foremost behavioral psychologists want me to be her graduate assistant. And we were studying two concepts which are taken for granted today. One was instinct. Instinct at that point in time was how does an animal learn how to do something? And the term was given by the psychology community of instinct, and we were studying how to prove that term. It was really neat, but unfortunately Uncle Sam decided that I had 12 days to get into the service of my choice because I had a draft number of 3. So 12 days later I was in the Navy, didn't get to go to graduate school, went to boot camp. Then I was selected to data processing A school. Then I went off to got selected to be an officer in the Navy, and I went to officer candidate school. Then I was selected to be in EOD school, and I was trying to disarm every ordnance from a cannonball to the most sophisticated nuclear weapon our government had. Interesting for an old hippie to be. But when you think about it, it made sense. I didn't want to drop bombs and kill anybody. I wanted to do what I thought was the most peaceful thing to do, which was to disarm bombs. Stupid. I never should have been in that field. I'm lucky I didn't blow myself away. But anyway, I finally got out of the service after 4 years, and I went back to California, was accepted into the graduate program at Northridge University in Southern California, and I had bought my first house. Paid $28,000 for a house that was not in a very good neighborhood. My grandmother lent me $1,000. I had a Pinto and no money in the bank. I had just got through hitchhiking all over the country for 6 months while I was collecting unemployment. It was wonderful. It was back in the good old days where you could hitchhike places and learn all sorts of different things, especially about the local culture. Can't do it anymore. But I went back to graduate school. I had my first home. My father calls me up and says, would you like to come back to Grand Rivers? Now, I had been to Grand Rivers before. I actually hitchhiked into Grand Rivers a couple times, and I don't know if you all know where Grand Rivers is, but it's down at Kentucky Lake. It is a town of 350 people. It was mostly boarded up, fallen down in economic despair. Not very many people knew about Grand Rivers, and there were only a couple businesses in town, and my dad says to me, he says, well, I would like you to come back and take care of your mom because I got a job working for the government. I've gone a lot. Mom and Dad had bought a little $19,000 motel that my grandmother had bought for them because Dad didn't have any money. So my grandmother bought him this little $19,000 motel. In the picture, this is the little motel back here. And this is actually my mother in front of her Vega. I had a Pinto. Michael Lee had a Vega. So we started out really rich in this process here. And my dad says to me, he says, son, if you'll come back to Grand Rivers and go in business with your mother, she has this thinks Grand Rivers needs a hamburger and ice cream parlor, I'd be glad to give you 50% of the business after 5 years. Now put it in perspective. You're in graduate school in the middle of Los Angeles, free. No military, no real obligations, thriving as city bus, paying your way through school, and your father wants you to move back to Grand Rivers, Kentucky. I told him, Dad, no thank you. I don't think so. I said, come on. You're offering me a 50% of a non-existent hamburger and ice cream parlor in a town of 350 people in the middle of Podunk, Kentucky? I don't think so, Dad. No thank you. Well, my mother kept thinking of the idea, and she kept thinking about it, and she kept pestering me about it, and I kept telling her no. But after being robbed 5 times in a year, my mother called me, and she said, well, why don't we call it Hamburger Patty's Ice Cream Parlor? So I talked to my life partner, Mike, and of which we've been together for 37 years now. And I talked to him about it, and he was from a little town in North Carolina, so we decided we would move. So we sold our house in 10 minutes, and we moved back to Grand Rivers, Kentucky. Now, folks, this is where the story takes a turn. This is what I moved back to. Now, my mother and father lived in one room of the little motel, and we lived in another room of the little motel. And my grandmother, my father's mother, lived in another room at the motel, and then there was a trailer next to it that some people rented. And we rented the room for $7.50 a night, and on the weekends we got $11.50 a night for the two rooms that weren't rented. And we started Hamburger Patty's Ice Cream Parlor. My mother didn't like the metal, concrete, cinder block looking facade on the building. Thought it was a little tacky, a little old, ugly. Had a little 3-foot sidewalk going across the front of it. So she built this front porch on it. Notice the round circular driveway. Notice our outdoor dining area. We had one lovely table with yellow, bright yellow. We were trying to get tourists to stop. And we had one little window right here that was the carryout window. Hamburger Patty's Ice Cream Parlor started. This is another picture of the motel when we started. This is where we came from. This is a wonderful treasure. I'm sort of the historian in my family. This is the original note. Now, for $8,000, that which we started Hamburger Patty's Ice Cream Parlor. Now, guys, it's signed by my mother in March, I think, 23rd of 1977, $8,000. And you can see the list of equipment she bought, handwritten. Could you imagine a bank taking a handwritten equipment list today? Handwritten. Now the only way my mother and father, remember we had two Vegas and a Pinto in our life, the only way my mother and father got this note was because the owner of the local Dairy Queen, about 12 miles from us, was upgrading his equipment. So we got his used equipment because he also was on the board of directors of the Bank of Benton. And so he was able to push this note through for us. So here we started, $8,000.
The first year in business, the restaurant did a little more than $8,000. Now let me tell you about a typical day. We only had 20 seats. We would swing on the swings under the porch. And we would wait for some unsuspecting tourist to pull up in front of our business. And they usually would take a look at the two of us swinging on the swing. And we wore overalls back then, red and white gingham check shirts. Mother had an afro at that time, because that was cool. So she had an afro on, and the two of us were swinging on the swing. Dad was away at work. Michael Lee was working at the Reed Crushed Stone, driving a Uke and going to Murray State. And the people would mostly try to look at us, take one look, and back out and go down the street to the local Iron Kettle. Damn. You can only stand so much of that before you start chasing the one car you have down. And Mother and I would run out to the car, mostly Mother, because she was more convincing and had more sympathetic looking eyes than I did, and would offer the people a free piece of pie if they would come and eat with us. The first year we played a lot of bridge, because Mother loved bridge and she taught me how to play. We played a lot of canasta, a great deal of Monopoly, and we did $8,000 in sales. This year we did, in the month of December, about $1,400,000 in sales. Now, we've been there 36 years. There's still only 350 people in the town of Grand Rivers. It looks a little different. It looks a whole bunch different. But we only have still 350 people. We have no liquor. The nearest town is probably 10, 12, 30 miles away. Paducah's the biggest town, that's 30 miles away. So everybody that had to come to the restaurant really was coming a great deal. We now have 450 seats. We employ 250 people. And if you do not have reservations, you can't get into the restaurant a whole bunch of the time, especially the month of December. We have a magnificent Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus, and 500,000 lights. So when you come to see our Santa Claus, you got Macy's Santa Claus, you know what I mean? So I've been in this contest for years, you know, Macy's and Gimbel's type of thing. This last year this last Christmas we had 5,000 children come to see Santa Claus. Stand in line in the cold to wait to see Santa Claus. And one of my favorite stories was there was two little twin 5-year-old girls that came to see Santa Claus. And Santa Claus asked the little girls what they wanted for Christmas. And the one little girl said to Santa Claus, "Santa, let me tell you, we were at the mall last night. And that we were sitting on the mall Santa's lap. And the mall Santa's asked us what we wanted for Christmas. We told him. We didn't need to waste his time because we were going to see the real Santa at Patty's. Yay, Patty's, we beat the mall Santa kind of thing. Yay, guys, now come on, that's really a big thing if you can beat the mall Santa." Christmas is a magnificent thing at Patty's. When I was growing up as a young man, my grandmother, my mother's mother, we lived in Hawaii, and she took us to a restaurant that was in an old pirate ship. And I remember that experience. Now, I was 26 years old when I went into the restaurant business. I remember that experience. That experience was probably one of the most defining things in my life in business, because I realized that whenever anybody came to my restaurant, it needed to be a memorable experience that you remembered for the rest of your life. So when you come to our restaurant, even after 36 years, you won't forget coming to it. We hardly advertise at all. We don't have the money to advertise. We never had the money to advertise.
I forgot to bring one picture with me of when our signs were originally painted. I put Patty's. It looked like a P from a, it looked like a polywalk, because I'm not an artist. But I couldn't afford to have somebody paint signs for me. So I painted them, and I have a picture of it at home. And underneath it, we have a breakfast menu. Two eggs, bacon, toast, or sausage and toast, hash browns, gravy, and coffee. Open 6 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night, and it cost $1.99. You can see why it took a lot to get to $8,000. So that's the essence of Patty's. My mother was a magnificent person. She loved life, adored life, loved everything about life. We were typically at the restaurant from 6 in the morning till 10 o'clock at night every day. And as I said, a lot of the time we didn't ever see anybody. We had one little fryer. We had one Gen Air stove that had two burners and a little griddle. That's what we cooked the hamburgers on. And we had an ice cream area that had 14 flavors of ice cream. I love to eat my own food. My mother and I got, as we developed into each other's areas, we drew a line. The bakery was hers, the rest of the restaurant was mine. My mother was a magnificent baker. This is one of her pies. This is called a chess pie. Every pie in the restaurant today is still her recipe, even though she's been gone for 14 years now. Well, I used to love to go dancing. And on Friday or Saturday night, if I had energy, I would run into Paducah and dance all night long. And then, folks, I came home to where I lived in this little motel where there were 14 flavors of hand-dipped ice cream. I might have had the munchies. And I decided to put different flavors of ice cream on the pie, and then whipped cream, and then caramel syrup, and chocolate syrup, and cherries, and cream de menthe syrup, and I created sinker pies. If all the food that you've eaten hadn't sunk the ship, if you eat one of my mother's pies, and with all my sinker pies, then you have the ship will sink. So, that's the story between the sinkers.
This is a chest sinker, but this is just the bottom of the chest pie.
I promise you, my mother was the first lady that I ever knew or had ever seen that knew how to create mile-high meringue pies. She had her own special secret on how to do it. Now, Martha Stewart and some of the other people came later. This is a small meringue pie. These are to-go pies. This is a coconut meringue pie. Magnificent to throw in somebody's face if you're mad at them. Makes a great impression, and it doesn't come off easy. You know, it's real sticky. So, anyway, we have a chocolate meringue, we have a lemon meringue, we have coconut meringue. We have about 20 different pies. Each waiter and waitress has to learn how to do the pies, has to learn how to recite the pie recipe, the order, and has to do it at every single table. You cannot go to Patty's without the server telling you all the pies. They have to memorize all the different desserts. It's quite a feat. And they usually get applause when they're done. I'm not going to do it. This is a picture of my mother and my father at their 50th anniversary party. In their day and age, love was everything. Family was everything. Commitment was everything. Trust was everything. Didn't always mean that you got along. Didn't always mean you agreed. But you stayed together and worked out your differences. Mom passed away later that year. This is the family today, or at least a year or two ago. My youngest brother, Michael, joined us 5 years later. He married Luana, who was a new hostess at Patty's on the Pier, and they have three children. The children are 20, 17, and 15 now. Ariel Teller is in charge, goes to the market with her mother. We buy all the gifts for this retail division of the company, and we have 6 gift shops. We have a miniature golf course. We have a llama. We have an emu. We have pigs. We have chickens. We have turkeys. We have rabbits. Farm animals. People from the city come and they just, whoa, the kids love it. Remember this, guys. 70% of the decisions are made by the children on where you're going to eat. We have animals.
And a five-pack horse.
Today, my family owns a great deal of the downtown of the community. We took almost every cent we've ever made and put it right back into the town, because there wasn't much of a town. Today, if you look up Patty's 1880 settlement online, you'll see how beautiful it has become. And at this point in time, I'm going to ask Eric to play you a little story, and you can actually hear some of the story of Patty's. Rooms that they rented for $7.50 a night, $11.50 on the weekend, and they were, it was just an old 1950-ish concrete block fishing camp.
And he said, why don't you stay home and figure out a way to make a living in this town, and I'll stay home. And when I came home, the next time he got the idea to start a hamburger race big block, which is, you know, cooking has always been what she was good at. And it all started from there. Next thing I know, we have a restaurant. So anyway, I had to work the next 5 years and send all money to keep the place going.
And Mother, bless her heart, had never kept the books. Dad always did that, but she kept the books. And by gosh, on the first day we opened, Mother realized that she had overdrawn the checking account by $8,000 additional dollars. So we were in the hole to start off with. And I think the business might have done $8,000 in sales the first year. And this year we're going to do somewhere around $8 million in sales. Single decision required a great deal of courage, because you were venturing into the unknown. You were venturing into a world that everyone told you you were going to fail in. Every step of the way, you had to fight every step of the way to get where we are today. People look and take everything for granted. Of course, most people don't understand. This is just the beginning of the rest of the dream, Patties. It will go on for generation upon generation.
I'm coach. Well, I loved it better than anything.
She loved everything in the world. And the day that she found out and told me that she was going to die, I went over to her house and we sat there and held hands and cried together. And she said to me, I said, Mom, if you could ask God for one thing, what would you like God to do for you? She said, I want 3 years. I want to be able to see my granddaughter Ariel grow up a little now, because at that time she was just a little baby. God gave her 3 years and 2 months. And the pictures that you're seeing are the last photographs and video of my mom and dad and the family together. And she is who she is, a magnificent mother and wife and friend.
Patty's Ice Cream Parlor has evolved into Patty's 1880 Settlement. When we first started the business, we only owned a very small piece of land that was where the motel is. Today, we own a significant part of the downtown. One of the things that I realized that when we walk out the door of Hamburger Patty's Ice Cream Parlor, there was an empty building across the little street in Grand Rivers. There was the old water company, and the roof had fallen in, the wood floors had fallen through, and that was what was out our front door. We didn't have any money to buy it. Remember, we started with $8,000. At one point in time, we got up to where we owed about $3.2 million. On October 1st of this year, Patty's 1880 Settlement, I'm proud to announce, will reach a milestone in our history and actually
be debt-free for the first time in 36 years. In that time, we encountered great obstacles. Tourism is a business that's very much like farming. It's very dependent upon the weather. If the weather's good, people come to the lakes. If the weather's not good, they don't come to the lakes. If there's an ice storm, they don't come to the lakes. Lots of things. So I had to come up with an idea of how do you overcome these things. So I came up with this idea that if Patty's was a special place, now we're talking a hamburger and ice cream parlor, everything was served in a wicker basket on a piece of tissue paper. We only had a three-hole sink. We didn't have a dishwasher. We only had one stove, one fryer, and we had one chest-height freezer, which my mother every afternoon around 2 o'clock would lay on top of and take a nap because somebody might come in and she might have to get up and go back to work, and it was the coolest place in the restaurant. You had to come up with something to make it different. So I figured if I could get every woman to bring their husband, get their husband to bring her to Patty's on her birthday and her anniversary, and if I was really lucky, Mother's Day, that's 3 days a year that if I could get every woman to come 3 days a year, I could become more successful. It worked. Once upon a time, prom kids started to come to Patty's, and I put out an ad on the personal section of the newspaper because that was the only thing that we could afford. And back then, personal ads were always read by everybody, much to the way they don't say that, but they did. And I put out an ad before Valentine's. Ladies, let me have a frank discussion with you. If the man in your life isn't going to think that you're special enough to bring you to Patty's on Valentine's Day, maybe you need to think about that man in your life. We were full that Valentine's Day. One of the best ads I ever came up with. My mother created, and I forgot to bring a pot of pot bread, but my father put in, my mother always wanted to be different. We always wanted to be unique. We didn't want to be ugly or anything, we just wanted to be unique. Am I unique? She came out with bread in a flower pot, clay pot. And 25 years ago, nobody else had clay in flower pots. So my father put an ad in the paper saying, or actually I think I helped him, but you really need to come and see Patty's new pot bread. The pot is really cool in the personal section. Lots of people came to see the pot bread. The next ad was, well, the people from the FDA have been here, inspected, and have commandeered one of the flower pot breads and have taken it to determine how much pot is really affecting the bread. More people came. The essence of what I'm trying to say to you is, my father, when he finally got to come home and retire, walked around with a pig on the end of the leash, up and down the street. He had hundreds of pictures taken of him. His pig became so famous, we had to put a phone on the doghouse in the front of the restaurant where the pig lived for the kids to call Calvin Swine. It was amazing. We've started, and still to this day, do unique things. And now I'd like to share you, Peggy and Brian and Juan came down to the restaurant a week ago, 10 days ago, and they were first timers, and this is what they brought back, their experience of Patty's.
singing Happy Birthday to Peggy.
Maybe you could tell us a bit about the window we're seeing, Chip.
That's William Cullen Bryant, the poet, literary big poet, and he was that was a gift to me to one of my clients many, many years ago. And it came, it's a Tiffany window, and it came out of the Spalding House in Upper New York. Some of my mom's collectibles. The print tractor is my 20-year-old niece's. I always loved Eddie Albert and Green Acres, and that's a exact model of that tractor that Eddie Albert used to ride around in Green Acres, and I found it for $500 in a farmer's field and brought it over there and parked it there next to that, which was where my grandmother's, that was my grandmother's house. You see in the very background there's a ramp over there. My grandmother, who was 94 years old, she worked in the restaurant until she was 94 in the gift shop, disinherited me because I put a ramp in front of her house because she was in a wheelchair and she didn't think anybody needed to know I was disinherited again when I took the bathroom door open so her wheelchair could get in there and made it bigger. I was disinherited for that too. So and bottom line, she did disinherit me. So anyway, my 19-year-old niece came up with the idea of painting the tractor pink. Now, folks, come on, let's look at this, really. If my gay ass had painted a pink tractor in the middle of a town of 350 people, what the world do you think the reaction was? But because my good-looking 19-year-old niece painted the tractor pink, it's a huge success. Everybody talks and celebrates about the pink tractor. It's a magnificent shot for teenage kids. Anyway, there's Brian leaning up against the pink tractor. It's probably the most photographed thing in the whole settlement. We have weddings. We had about 124 weddings last year. That's my house that I bought for $25,000 36 years ago. It didn't look like that. History is very important to me. I'm the historian of the family, and I've collected, I have almost everything. My mother and father was in their house when they passed away, so I wrote some books. Unfortunately, I only had 5 of these. The new edition of them didn't come in. It was supposed to be in already, but it didn't come in yet. I wrote this in honor of my mother. I'm one of these people that's really worried about how I'm going to be portrayed in history. So I like, you know, write things down so they'll have to destroy all this history that I, you know, every time somebody buys one of these, it goes somewhere in the paper. The family's going to have a hard time erasing and destroying and finding every copy that I put out there. So I wrote a story, but this one is in honor of my mother. When my mother was dying, we were in Jamaica at the time. And I sat underneath the coconut tree and I wrote a story about my mother. She could only write on a chalkboard. She couldn't talk at that point in time. And she didn't want all the pictures in the book. And it was one of the few times in my life she was ever really angry at me because I tried to be a good kid. And I told her within an argument about, Mother, no, you are a pioneer in life. My older sister married a black man in 1969. When you talk about guess who's coming to dinner, it was really guess who's coming to dinner. And then in 75, Mike and I got married. And my mother and father supported us. The town didn't support us. In the most recent election, when I ran for re-election to the city council after my father died, I was appointed to the city council in his seat, and when I had to run for re-election, I came in 10th out of 10 people running for re-election to the city of Grand Rivers. But, okay.
politics isn't my game. So I wrote history. This is about my mother. She was a great lady. She was a pioneer. I'll never forget one day we were swinging on the swing. And a pickup load of teenagers drove up in front of the restaurant and stopped and started yelling obscenities. And my father had a Webcor kettle in the front yard where he cooked dinner for the family. Well, everybody loved what he was cooking in the kettle. He was a marvelous cook, especially with grilling stuff. That's where I learned how to do the pork chop. So, Mom, one day, these young adults started yelling obscenities and things, ran over to the kettle, grabbed the long fork that Dad used to flip over the meat, and went running after the children, or the teenagers in the pickup truck, and she was going to fork them to death. I was never so proud of my mother in my life. So she has book. Three years later, my father was still living. He really started dying the day my mother found out she was going to die. They were really wonderfully in love, even though they fought like cats and dogs sometimes. They had a problem trying to figure out who was going to be right, and they usually were both right. But my dad, at the end, after my mom died, was very lonely and wouldn't really come back out into the public very much. So I would go over every Sunday afternoon and I would play double solitaire with him, and we'd watch the golf games. And 3 weeks before he died, I took the first manuscript to him about who he was to me as a father. I wrote this book in his honor about who he meant, what he meant to me as a father. And I took the first printed manuscript over to him to let him read, and he started crying. He was sitting, and he was not the kind of man that would cry. And he started crying, and he told me to read it to him, so I started reading to him, and then I started crying. Needless to say, he passed away suddenly 3 weeks later, and so his history is preserved. I want to warn you, if anybody wants a book, there's no death, there's no dying, there's no fighting, there's no arguing, it's love stories. I only write books when I'm happy. I'm not an English major. If I didn't have Michael Lee to correct everything that I wrote, because I write everything longhand because I can't type very fast. So don't expect something to be some grand glorious story. It's just a story book. A few years ago, 6 years ago, there was this mallard duck family that lived across the street from our house. And they came from Patty's settlement, and they went over to our house, and they made their nest in our front yard. Now, how cool is that, guys? You know, if a wild animal is at such peace in your front yard that they decide to raise their family in your front yard, how cool is that? I mean, I think that was really cool. Well, Maggie May, who's in the car this evening, and her older sister, Sophie Sue, who passed away recently, decided that it was really cool that they had this duck family in front of the house. So they would go, every time we'd walk out of the house, they'd go over and visit with the mallard duck family. Of course, there was a lot of woof, 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 and quack, 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 and of course, there was a lot more quack, 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 than woof, 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 woof. But anyway, this went on every morning, and then we would go to work across the street at the Remax office or at the Bed and Breakfast or wherever, Patty's or wherever job we wanted to do that day. And when we came home, we had the same long discussion between Mama Duck, Daddy Duck, and Maggie May especially, because Maggie was just 6 months old, so she was just a puppy too. Sophie was 14 and really could care less about the duck family. So after about 5 weeks of this, we come home, and Maggie runs over to the duck family's nest, and the ducks, Mama Duck and Daddy Duck, and four of the five ducklings are gone, and there's just an egg. An egg that happened to look like a tennis ball. This is our house with Chibi Duck. And I want you to know that it's really fun that a gay man finally got to write a book that starts Once Upon a Time. I mean, girls, how many gay men don't get to write a fairy tale? Ooh, it's so much fun. Anyway, this is a true story. Starts Once Upon a Time. Disney, be so proud of me. This is Sophie Sue. Sophie Sue, Maggie May, and Chibi's wonderful Southern Belle mother. And one day they got up and they ran one across the street to Patty's to meet all the other duck families, and in their excitement they left Chibi in the nest, and it has an egg. And so we come home and we find the egg in the nest. So Maggie brings it over to us. Oh, look, Dads, look, we found a tennis ball. No, it was a duck egg. So we had put it back over in the nest, sat on the steps, making sure nothing happened to it. And after a while, we decided we better take the egg inside. So we took the egg inside, put it in a copy paper box with a heating pad, sat there and watched the egg hatch. Didn't hatch. So finally I told Michael, I said, you better get that egg, the baby, out of there, because he was going weaker and weaker. So he sat there with a pair of tweezers and he slowly picked the shell away from the egg, and then he'd sit it down and let the baby try to get out naturally, and that wasn't working, so he'd pick it up some more and he'd take some more pieces of the shell off. And finally, on a Sunday afternoon, it was about 24 hours he'd been there, we said, you better get him out of there because he's getting really weak. You could hear his little peeping was getting weaker. So we took him out of the egg, and he was this bloody, black, ugly little duckling. He lived to be 5, and then about a year ago, this good-looking female came by, met his fancy, and they flew off to create their own family. This is the autobiography of G.B. Duck. It is also the story of Michael Lee and I, and who we are as people. How loving we are, how caring we are, how compassionate we are, and what a wonderful family we have. And in this day and age, guys, I told you I grew up in the Leave It to Beaver family. You know, we had 4 kids, mom and dad, everybody was there. Today, the families may have 2 moms, 2 dads, 1 mom and a stepdad, 1 dad and a stepmom, or 2 stepmoms, or an Oriental child, or a black child, or a Mexican child, and a white child, and the families are all different. So Chibi told the story about his family. He doesn't know anything about gay. All he knows is he has a little dad, and a big dad, and 2 four-legged sisters. And he loved his family. He loved his sisters. I mean, he was a house duck, guys. He lived in the house, he rode in the car, he rode in a golf cart, loved to be in attention in public. He was wonderful fun. He and Maggie Mae would chase each other around the dining room table, and then around the living room table, and then around the dining room table, and then into the kitchen, around the island in the kitchen, and all through the house when they got home. It was wonderful fun. The mess that he left behind was rather troublesome. Anyway, this is the story of Chibi Duck Rode, and he wrote it to everybody. And one of the things that is in this book, the essence of this book, I'm almost done here, guys, are life lessons. Chibi wrote 14 life lessons. He would tell a story about his life. First time he met, when he came home, he'd tell you tell the kids 2 or 3 pages of stories about how his life went. He'd tell another life lesson. These are marvelous stories, kids. Really, really beautiful stories. And then he's got recipes. My mother taught me how to cook. A lot of people today don't take the time to teach the kids how to cook. So at the end of the evening or the end of the afternoon, you can take the kids and you can go make chocolate gravy. Simple, easy recipes for even mom and dads to know how to cook. But in the end of the story, you'll find it doesn't matter what your family looked like. It doesn't matter what your brother or sister look like or who your mom and dad are. As long as there's love in your life and love in your home and love in your heart, you've got a good family. And that's my story. And thank you all for inviting me here.
I have time for a question or two. Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, there are the other two are recipe books as well. The first one, the brown one and the green one, both have recipes at Patty's, and they were my mother's recipes.
And if you're curious, we were, Peggy and I reviewed this book for the Daily News. One of the beauties of the recipes is in their simplicity, in that you can imagine yourself cooking these things, not as well as Patty did or Chip, but yes.
Is the recipe for that good-looking pie over there... Is it coconut cream, the one with...
I think it's in the green book. I don't think it's in the brown book, but I do think... We were reluctant at first. There were so many people trying to copy what we did. You know, we're famous for a 2-inch thick pork chop. They weigh 20, 16, 18, 22 ounces. Believe it or not, guys, there's only one company in America that we can get the chops from, and that's in California. I can't produce enough of them because our chops are always made from the center cut. There's only 5 chops that you can get out of the center loin of a pork loin, and they all have to be equal. I can't give you one that's this big and you one that's this big, so they're all in that center cut. And there's only one company in California that produces enough pigs and has enough things. And one of the biggest problems that we ran into was the companies around here that did it when we were growing didn't know what to do with all the leftover products. Well, nowadays they've evolved into having the 1-inch pork chop. We sell the 1-inch pork chops, which are a little different. We can take several more out of the loin. And then they also, you know, they make so much sausage and things and barbecue now that the big companies can do that. But it's a big company in California that sent us all our pork chops.
Other questions about cooking, restaurants, life?
Yes. Thank you, Michael Lee, for coming. Your stories are beautiful. I'm very touched. And you know, I hate to bring the personal back to something practical, but I was wondering early on if there was, like, what was the turning point? You're starting out and you're making such a small amount of money at the restaurant, and now you make a big chunk of change, and yet it is surprising that 37 years you're finally kind of getting in the black, I guess. Point being, is it how many years were you in business before something turned and you thought, oh, this is actually going to work?
Well, so I can remember one time is asking my bookkeeper, how much money do we have to do a day to pay the bills? She said $350. You've got to reach averaging $350. And we thought that was almost an unimaginable, achievable thing. I will go back to this. I'm not a quitter. I've always been a fighter. Given me a stage, give me an opportunity, I'll fight like hell. And quitting has never been an option. My mother and father taught me that, and it has never been an option. I mean, we could have thrown in the towel hundreds of times, but it wasn't an option. I've always been successful in my own mind. Whether I was in other people's minds wasn't as important as how I felt in my own mind. Was I being successful? My dad taught me that success was really important. So all of you that are going to college now, keep that in your mind. Focus on being successful. I mean, it's up to you. You can do it if you really keep your mind to it. And we're an example of that. I mean, we're an American success story. I mean, it's an honor to be able to stand here and tell you all my family is an American success story. It's wonderful that there are still ways for us as individuals to become successful in a small way in a small town, as long as you feel and dream the dreams. I never, ever thought in the beginning about what it would become today. I mean, it was hard enough to figure out how to be successful as a hamburger and ice cream parlor. I mean, it was very, very difficult, but I don't quit. It's never been an option.
How does the restaurant affect the economy of your 350-person town?
We're at a very interesting crossroads in our life. I was talking to Nancy about this. Listen, guys, I'm not going to be. I was a Republican almost my whole life until recently. This young man called Obama came to be, and one of the things that he is a very, to me, a very special man, and one of the things he wants to provide every employee or every person in our country health care. I want everyone in my business to have health care. Now, only at this point in time, when I first started health care in my company, there were 26 managers that had health care, and the bill cost $36,000. Today, I have 16 managers with health care, and the bill cost $186,000. Now, we are looking at putting 250 people with health care. Now, why should a dishwasher not get health care because he only makes $10 an hour? Come on, that's the hardest job in the restaurant. The men and the women and kids that do that are, trust me, I did it for years, they deserve health care. The problem is that the government is telling us that my family is going to have to come up with $500,000 to $1.2 million in additional revenue just to pay the increase in health insurance for my employees. Guys, my company, even though it did that great number of $8 million, it only does about $250,000 to $300,000 profit a year, of which all that money goes right back into upgrading the plant, because when you put thousands and thousands and thousands of people going through your house kind of thing, it requires constant new carpeting, constant new painting, constant everything, new flowers every season, new decorations every year. Guys, we had three decorators that do nothing but decorate that restaurant. Never one time in all these years has one room ever been the same. Ever. And it's changed completely five times a year. The decorations in that restaurant, the whole decorations are changed five times a year. What does Outback Steakhouse have? A parking lot that's asphalt and a look that never changes. Patty's has got gardens everywhere and animals. We have three full-time decorators. We have two animal caretakers. We have six groundskeepers. Outback doesn't have any of that. So here we are. First time in our life we're going to be debt-free. But even taking that $18,000 a month mortgage payment and multiplying it by 12 doesn't come anywhere near $500,000 or $1,200,000. So where is it going to come from? How's it going to happen? Call me in 6 months or a year and I'll tell you where we're at. Now, the question was, what happens, what are we in relationship with that town? If Patty's goes under and Patty's 1880 settlement goes under, the brand new bank in town is 3 years old. Can you imagine that, guys? A town of 350 people without an ATM machine now has a new $1 million bank. Needed some place to process that $8 million and two marinas that are in town. And all those employees cashing their checks and going to check them. What's going to happen to that bank? What's going to happen to the water department? We're the biggest customer. All the retail shops with one in the town belong to my family. If they all go under, and all the property that we own in town will go under and be open and vacant like it was when I first came there. So why would anybody want to come to Grand Rivers if the grocery store is closed, the post office is out of business, all the retail shops are out of business in a town of 350 people? And guys, we're competing against Bowling Green as a tourism attraction. We're a town of 350 people. We don't even have liquor. But let me tell you something about that. I don't ever want liquor. When you come to my restaurant, it opens at 10:30 in the morning now. Last month in December, if you didn't have reservation by 11 o'clock, you couldn't get in until 9 o'clock or 9:30 at night. That's 450 seats turning over about six times during the day. When you come to my restaurant, if you as a young couple came to the restaurant, or you folks came to celebrate an anniversary and you came and you wanted a reservation at 6 o'clock at night, I know it's going to take you an hour and a half to eat at my restaurant. If you came, yeah, I knew it would take an hour and 45 minutes. If 8 or more come, it takes 2 hours and 15 minutes. I know that. So every table that has a reservation, I know how soon to book it. if I introduced a bottle of wine at your table and a couple of margaritas at your table, you're going to stay there an unlimited X amount of time because I provide you a magnificent atmosphere to stay in, and you're happy and you're relaxed because I don't hurry you. I give you an hour and a half to eat lunch. I give you an hour and a half to eat dinner. So with that in mind, my whole dang reservation system would be unbelievably out of whack. So I don't want liquor. And I used to own the biggest dance club in Paducah. And bottom line is, the lawsuits and stuff around liquor are awful. I like Grand Rivers to be wet someday so I could attract a Marriott Corporation where they could bring their type of $23 million project to town to raise the tax base so the town could build more things like more sidewalks and things. Yes, I would like that, but Patty's will never have liquor. It's not necessary.
The fine folks at Patty's have brought some of their culinary magnificent desserts and rabbits to live to taste one of them. We hope you'll just stay along and join us.
Guys, I brought some pieces of pie, and I've got some little dishes, and I've got some plates, and I've got some pork.
Wow. And we've got some cookbooks along to Delta, if you'd like to get a copy of Patty's. Is certainly one of my favorite cookbooks. I've reviewed awful lot of cookbooks, and it's certainly highly recommended. We'll be signing those up after here. So, Peggy, we have a little token of appreciation for our author tonight.
How can you beat up a project like this that holds a whole town together? Let me tell you, there is no way that we could ever say thank you enough just for being here. So these are just little tokens of saying hi. Yes.
Well, thank you for coming out to such an unpleasant evening. It's been a fun time, and we hope you'll join us up at the table for some desserts, and we'll be doing this again on March 7th. We'll have Jason Howard here talking about Kentucky roots of popular music, and thanks, and good evening.